The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 127.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I really enjoy talking to. He's one of my favorites. I have a tremendous amount of respect for this gentleman that really needs no introduction. His name is Peter Schiff. Peter, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Well, thanks, George, for having me on, and I hope you're enjoying the sun and the beaches there in St. Bart's.
I absolutely am. So we were just talking before we started recording about what's going on with Puerto Rico and Act 2022, but more specifically, what's going on with their lockdown process. And it just sounds completely insane. I've got to go there next week to renew my license. So you're telling me all the horror stories, but you've got a very interesting concept of maybe they're trying to go overboard to maybe get some more money coming in if Biden gets in office. Can you outline that for the viewers and listeners? I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, well, I think that there's no way the Puerto Ricans would be this reckless and irresponsible unless they really had an ulterior motive. And first of all, you have to realize that that $600 a week in supplemental unemployment benefits, right, that went a lot further in Puerto Rico, because imagine, you know, something like two-thirds of the Americans were earning less when they had a job than they were getting paid to be unemployed. Well, the numbers are even greater in Puerto Rico. I'd say maybe 90% of the workers earned more on unemployment than going back to their job. So they certainly have an incentive to keep people unemployed because they'll make a lot more money. Of course, they won't be providing goods and services, so it's not good for the local economy to have everybody just sitting at home collecting welfare checks. But also, I think that maybe the Puerto Rican government deliberately wants to make their fiscal situation as bad as possible, blame it all on COVID-19, and then use that as an excuse to get a much bigger federal bailout once Biden is in office and they can collect a little bit of their political payback, because of course the Puerto Ricans, they back the Democrats, even though they can't vote in the presidential election. There's a lot of Puerto Ricans that do vote that live in Florida and other states. And I think if they do get a clean sweep in Congress, that should greenlight a pretty big bailout for Puerto Rico. And so I think that's probably their end game.
Yeah, and you're telling me about some of the restrictions, how draconian they are. And I haven't been back to the U.S. other than maybe just a couple weeks in Fort Lauderdale when I was coming to St. Bart's from Medellin. I think you've maybe been up in Connecticut. How are the regulations as far as lockdown in Puerto Rico compared to what you're seeing in the States?
Well, it's much, much worse in Puerto Rico. I mean, you have curfews in Puerto Rico. You can't go out. I mean, they keep changing it. Right now, I think it's 10 to 5 a.m., but they've had it as early as 7 o'clock when I was there at one point. Sundays are mandatory closures. Nothing is open on Sundays, really. And you can't even have friends over. They've banned social gatherings on Sundays. So, I mean, A, forget about going to church, but you can't even invite your buddies over on Sunday. You pretty much have to stay at home with your family. The beaches, they're allowing you to go on the beach for athletic activities, but you can't sunbathe. You can't go to the beach and spread out a towel and lie on it. You can't have an umbrella or a picnic basket. So all that's done. All the pools are closed, so you don't have any pools. The restaurants are open, but not on Sundays, only for takeout. And they're at 25% capacity, only outdoor seating, and no alcohol. So, I mean, it doesn't even make a sense. I mean, if they're going to let people go to a restaurant, why can't they order a drink? I mean, what's the big deal? But it seems like they're deliberately trying to make sure that restaurants can't make any money. And of course, when you come to Puerto Rico, you need to prove that you've had a swab COVID test within 3 days of your visit. Right. Otherwise, you have to quarantine yourself for 2 weeks or, you know, the length of your stay. So to the extent that anybody was thinking about coming to Puerto Rico, they're going to rethink that once they realize the restrictions that they're going to be subjected to.
I mean, I think what most people are maybe is going through their mind right now is, wow, I wonder if Peter is second guessing his decision. to move to Puerto Rico for Act 2022. And I know I'm kind of right there with you with the Act 2022. What are you thinking? Just on a personal level.
No. I mean, I'm not second guessing at all. And, you know, they actually have mandatory masks. You have to wear a mask anywhere in public or you get a $100 fine for that. But look, COVID's not going to last forever. But high taxes in the U.S. probably will. I'm fine with my decision to move in Puerto Rico. And there are a lot of things I like about Puerto Rico. It's not just about the fact that the taxes are much lower. If it was only about low taxes, then I wouldn't live there. But I really do enjoy it. You haven't spent nearly as much time there as I have. So, you know, it's a nice place to live. It's a great place for the kids to grow up. Yeah. So I enjoy the lifestyle. But yeah, I mean, the government is way overboard when it comes to COVID. I mean, that's for sure. But I mean, that's kind of what you expect in Puerto Rico. I mean, that's why the island is in so much trouble. The government has done so much to hurt the economy. What the Washington hasn't done with the minimum wage and the Jones Act and stuff like this, San Juan has done a lot to sabotage their own economy. Really, the only good thing they've done, as far as I know, is the tax incentives that brought me there and you there and a lot of other entrepreneurs that are really making a positive difference in Puerto Rico right now by providing a lot of capital, a lot of economic activity, a lot of employment opportunities. So that's really the only thing positive that the island has going. And that is actually going to increase significantly next year, because taxes in the United States are going to go way up in 2021. I mean, I think even if Trump gets reelected, I think they're going to end up raising taxes. But if Trump loses, which is the most likely scenario at this point, there will be significant increases in taxes at the upper end, right? The marginal rate and on corporations, on individuals, very sharp increases on capital gains. Mm. So I think you're going to see just a huge inflow. I think 2021, we could have more people coming to Puerto Rico in that year than in all the years prior since 2012, when they first enacted these incentives. I think we'll get more people in 2021 than in all the years from 2012 through 2020 combined.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think property taxes are going to go up as well. One thing that you touched on in one of your last podcasts, I believe, and I'd love for you to expand on this, is California and this wealth tax that they're proposing, this 0.4%, on, I think it's over 30 million, but in my opinion, that's going to come down and the tax is going to go up like most taxes, but it's retroactive going back like 10 years or something like that. So, I mean, let's talk about that a little bit and try to figure out who in their right mind would stay in California right now if you know the government can come back and tax you going up into 2030 or beyond.
Well, that means if they get away with it, even the people that were smart enough to leave a few years ago are not out of harm's way yet.
Yeah.
But number one, I think the fact that California is even suggesting something like this, to me, that's enough to just go nowhere near the state. I mean, don't even think about living there because it may be one of these things, you know, where it's the Hotel California. You check in, you can never check out. In fact, I joked on my podcast, I would be afraid to go to college in California, or certainly go to law school or medical school, because what they're saying is if you accumulated the wealth while you lived in California, we have a right to tax it even after you leave California. Mm-hmm. Well, if that theory holds, they could just as easily say, hey, you got your law degree in California, so we want a piece of everything you earn as a lawyer. You know, right. You got your medical degree in California, so we own you. You know, we want to get a piece of what you earn as a doctor. So I wouldn't even go anywhere near California. I'm glad I got the hell out of there myself in 2005. So I don't think they could go all the way back then and try to tax me, because it's well beyond that 10-year number, which is also arbitrary. I mean, how'd they get 10 years? But I think the fact that they're trying to do this shows that they realized that they're driving people out of the state. And so they're trying to figure out how to tax people who not only leave in the future to escape the higher tax, but who have already left to get out of the taxes. But yeah. And yeah, you're right. The threshold is going to come down from 30 million, because they're not going to get a lot of revenue. So they're going to bring it down to 20 million or 15 million. But then inflation is going to push a lot of people up A lot of people that have $10 million net worths might find that they have $20 million net worths, but they'll be poorer because the prices will rise more than their net worths.
Right.
But inflation will end up pushing a lot of people into the wealth tax bracket. But of course, the wealth tax is going to be very expensive to comply with because every single year you have to hire appraisers to figure out what your stuff is worth, because they're not just taxing publicly traded stocks where you could just look at the closing price and, you know, multiply it by the number of shares you have.
Right.
They're taxing interest in privately held companies, which you don't know what they're worth because
like,
they're not trading.
How much is my YouTube channel worth? How much is your podcast?
Yeah, I don't know. You got to have to go figure it out. And then you have to figure it out every year. Yeah. And, you know, what if you own some art? I mean, what is each painting that you have worth? What about if you have an antique car? You have, you know, you're supposed to add up everything that you have. The only thing they're exempting is your real estate because you're already paying a property tax there. So for now, they're not going to try to, you know, tax you again on the asset that they're already taxing you on. But for me, it would be terrible because I have so many interests in privately held companies, you know, valuing those things. And of course, they're not even liquid. So, I mean, you're going to pay taxes on something that doesn't even have any liquidity. And remember, the taxes every single year. So if it's 0.4%, that's every year.
Right.
So it's year after year after year. So after 10 years, that's 4% of the value of these assets that you've paid in taxes, assuming they don't raise the rate, you know?
Yeah. And I think I remember you outlining, this was probably 6 months ago or so, on one of your podcasts, how the income tax started in 1913. And everyone thought, oh, well, it's just on the rich, so it's a good thing. And then sure enough, by 1918, because of World War I, it went up on the rich. But then in the 1920s, it was still very high. But then I believe it was throughout the 40s and the 50s, the income tax on the middle class went up even higher than it was a percentage than it was going up on the rich. So the bulk of the increases in income taxes actually came from the poor and middle class. If you look at the whole span of the income tax.
Oh, I mean, it's a classic bait and switch. Camel's nose under the tent. The government duped the public into thinking they were going to soak the rich. And in fact, if you go back to the populist movement, the reason that the income tax was supported was because it was supposed to actually be a trade-off for tariffs.
Right.
Because before the income tax, pretty much all the money that the government collected to run on came from tariffs. And contrary to what Donald Trump says, everybody knew back then that the middle class paid the tariffs because it just increased the price of the goods they were buying. And so it fell more heavily on the middle class and the poor than it did on the rich. And so the idea was, hey, if we have this income tax on the rich, we can get rid of the tariffs on the middle class and the poor. So that was why the middle class was so in favor of it. It wasn't that they wanted to soak the rich so much, is that they didn't want to pay the tariffs anymore. And this was a way out of the tariffs because they had to shift the cost of government to somebody else. And so that was the promise that the government made. And that's why the income tax was supported by the people. And then when the Supreme Court originally struck it down as being unconstitutional, the Supreme Court was vilified as, you know, being in the pockets of the rich. They weren't for the common man. But then, you know, they eventually amended the Constitution to kind of get around the Supreme Court and get around the Constitution. And initially, yes, I mean, the income tax was 2-4%. I think there was an initial call to limit it. They wanted to put a cap on it of like 6%, which I wish they'd have done. But they kind of voted it down because they were saying, well, if we put a cap at 6%, they might actually raise it that high. So they should have just made the cap lower, but instead they didn't have a cap at all. And they didn't waste time. As soon as World War I started, they jacked up the rates. But by the time World War II started, that's when they really clobbered the middle class.
Yeah.
Because in 1940, not even 10% of Americans paid the income tax, even with the changes since 1913. But in 1942, they created the withholding tax. And now all of a sudden, better than 33% of Americans were now paying the income tax. And the rates they were paying were much, much higher than the original rates that applied to Vanderbilt, Carnegie, Rockefeller. So in the end, Americans now, you know, we've got the tariffs back under Trump, but we've got tariffs and we got an income tax. And the middle class, again, is paying rates that nobody would have even conceived of imposing on Rockefeller back then. So, you know, you make a deal with the devil and this is what happens to you.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the economy. I know the other day you were referencing that so many people think that the Fed has this huge responsibility and that they can just wave the magic wand and they can solve all of our problems in the real economy. But you pointed out the fact that the Fed can't stimulate the economy. Really, the only thing the Fed can do is stimulate the stock market. If they're even doing that. So, and I know it sounds pretty simplistic, but you outlined some detailed factors that really make us understand, I think even better, that the Fed cannot create goods and services. They can't increase production in the real economy. If there's an argument saying they could only decrease it. So how is the real economy now disconnected from the stock market, number one? And then help us understand why the Fed can only stimulate the market, but what we should be worried about is the production of goods and services in the real economy.
Yeah, I think the disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street has never been greater.
Yeah.
In fact, I think really the worse things get on Main Street, the better they get on Wall Street. I mean, that is the situation that we have now. What's bad for Main Street is good for Wall Street, right? And that's because the worse the economy gets, the more money the Fed creates. And the bigger deficits that they run, the more debt that they monetize. None of this actually helps the real economy, but it does help inflate the stock market bubble. It provides the air to make that bubble bigger. So bad news is good news as far as the stock market is concerned, but also to the extent that the Main Street economy gets shut down by COVID-19 or by government mandates, the companies that are most affected are the smaller privately owned companies. These mega publicly traded companies actually benefit from a reduction in competition from those companies. And you have a lot of these big cap tech companies that dominate the averages that are the only ones that are really going up. And you know, the weaker the economy is, the fewer the stocks that can withstand that. And so what happens is everybody tries to crowd into the same lifeboat. They want to get off of a lot of these companies that are seeing their earnings decline. And everybody is trying to pile into this crowded lifeboat of a handful of FANG stocks. But since those are the stocks that dominate the indexes, the more people chase into those stocks as the price goes up, well, the market averages keep going up, even as the internals are bad and you don't have, good breath. So all this is helping the market. But yeah, I mean, I think the biggest damage that is happening is the belief that the Fed can help the economy. Because this is causing policymakers to make very bad decisions, and particularly at the state level, but also at the federal level, on how to approach this disease, how to approach our response to COVID-19. Because nobody is doing a cost-benefit analysis of the impact on the economy of our response. Because everybody just assumes, well, whatever damage we do, if businesses are in trouble, if workers aren't getting paid, well, the Fed will just replace their lost income. Right. So if you're of the opinion that whatever damage we do from mandated shutdowns and, all these quarantines and stay-at-home orders, if all this is okay because the government will just print money and give it to businesses to bail them out, give it to the banks, give it to the airlines, give it to the hotels, give it to small business, give it to workers who aren't working. In fact, not only are we going to replace the incomes that people have lost, we're going to give them a raise. Yeah. We're going to make it so people are actually better off. We're going to pay people more money not to work than what they earned when they were working. So as long as you think all this can happen and it works, it is really distorting our policy. If people realized that there was no free lunch, if the Fed basically made it clear, we're not monetizing any of this, you can't do this. If everybody knew that, well, then we would have a very, very different response. And unfortunately, we're actually doing far more damage to the economy based on our response to COVID than COVID itself. It's the deficits and the money printing that are going to inflict much more damage to the economy than anything that we would have experienced simply from the virus. And yes, in the short run, the stock market is going up in response to all the money printing, but this is not healthy for the economy. Having an overvalued stock market sends bad economic signals throughout the economy. And so a lot of mistakes are being made because of the overpriced stock market. And so those bad decisions based on inflated asset prices and a phony wealth effect is causing additional damage. And that all that extra damage is going to be apparent when the bubble deflates.
Because we're misallocating resources because we're getting a false price signal from the market itself. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people are doing things based on the value of their stock portfolios that they would not do if their stock portfolios were lower. But there's also a lot of companies, because of what the government is doing, a lot of companies that should have failed are not only not failing, they're actually going deeper into debt. They're borrowing even more money. So had we allowed them to default, the losses would have been smaller because they would have defaulted on a lower amount of debt. But thanks to the Fed, when these companies do eventually default, it's on a much bigger debt. And so the losses to the lenders are going to be much greater because of the reprieve that the Fed granted. But none of these companies are actually restructuring in a way that all of a sudden they're viable. We're just subsidizing these companies to continue to pursue the same policies that bankrupted them before, or that would have bankrupted them had the Fed not come to the rescue.
Yeah.
But what we're doing though is we're basically trapping these resources where they are and where they've already been misallocated based on artificially low interest rates of the past. And now we're preventing those resources to move to where they really need to be going to be efficiently allocated. So we're solidifying the mistakes that we've made, and now we're expanding the size of those mistakes. And so we're delaying any kind of real economic recovery that might have ultimately taken place had the Fed allowed the market to reset.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Yeah, because you're talking about Schumpeter's creative destruction. And so for the people who might not be familiar with that, help them understand why this works. And, you know, going back to 2008, you know, why should we have let AIG go bust? Why should we have let all these, you know, GM or whatever? And today, why should we let Delta or American Airlines or Boeing? I mean, you hear the argument against that. Well, Peter, we can't do that. It's going to destroy all these jobs. How will we get from one place to the other if we don't have the airline? But it's people who really don't understand Chapter 7 and Chapter 11, I think, first and foremost. And then they haven't really thought through the benefits of these companies going bust and those resources going to younger, maybe smarter, more efficient, more prudent, for sure,
yep,
entrepreneurs who can take those resources and take our whole economy really to the next level. So, and I'm sure you've studied this extensively. Can you explain that for kind of the average person?
Yeah, I mean, certainly as long as people want to travel, we're going to have an airline industry. But the airline industry has to reflect economic reality. It has to reflect true supply and demand for air travel. And so the market has to function in a way that the airlines create value, not destroy it. So they have to be able to transport us around at a cost that's lower than what we're willing to pay for the tickets. And if they can't do that, then the industry needs to restructure. And it needs to kind of reset in a way that it's viable. And one of the main reasons that the airlines don't work is because they have too much debt, right? They have to service all this debt. And so that, you know, makes it hard for them to deliver air travel at a cost that makes sense. But when you allow for the bankruptcy, then the new owners of the airlines don't have all this legacy debt. Right. That's gone. And in fact, the new owners may be the old bondholders. The creditors end up taking over the company because the initial equity owners ran it into the ground. And so now you bring in new management that can kind of reset everything and get the industry on a scale that makes sense, because all businesses need to be able to generate a profit. Because what that means, when you're generating a profit, it means that you are taking scarce resources and you're using them in an efficient way, because you're able to combine land, labor, and capital in such a way that you could take, you know, a dollar's worth of land, labor, and capital and create $1.10 or $1.20 or $2 worth of economic value. And the way the value is judged is the willingness of consumers to voluntarily buy your product for more than it costs you to make it.
Right.
And but if you can't sell your product at a profit, then the market is telling you you are destroying value, because resources are not unlimited. They are scarce. And resources that are used by one business are therefore not available to be used by another business. So we want to make sure that the resources are used in the most efficient way possible. And so we want those resources allocated to profitable companies, and we want unprofitable companies to either restructure to become profitable or go out of business. Either way, resources get freed up to their highest and best use. But what happens when you try to bail out companies that the market wants to fail, you prevent that from happening. And that's the creative destruction, is that if you have a business that is misallocating land, labor, and capital, by destroying that business, you are freeing up those resources to go someplace else. And now they're going to go someplace else where they're economically viable. But we can't put those resources to viable use until we free them up from inviable use. And what the Fed wants to do is trap them in place and prevent the market from doing that, because everybody is focused on the obvious impact of the company that goes out of business and the workers that lose their jobs. And what they don't understand is the benefit to the overall economy of having those resources reallocated someplace else. So you can see what you lose, but what you don't see is what we would have gained by a more effective use of those resources.
Yeah, it reminds me of what's going on in Japan over the past few decades, and then Hazlitt. You know, it's not just about the seen, it's about the unseen. I was listening to Dr. Lacey Hunt the other day, and he was talking about the effects that debt, government debt especially, has on the economy. And a lot of people that are maybe in the MMT crowd or in other areas of, we'll call it economics, they see like a debt jubilee as an answer. So in other words, if the Fed has all of the treasuries on their balance sheet, it's just a asset for them. It's a liability for the government. And bam, you just click a button, you take the scoreboard back to zero, and you just start right from scratch, and we're all good to go, right? Because we owe it to ourselves. But and I'd love to get your opinion on this. Dr. Hunt said that's not really the case. And if you think about it right now, as an example, the government is over 50% of GDP in the United States, government spending. So even if you took the debt back to zero, you still have the misallocation of resources that have been created by the government.
Yeah, but the other problem is, even if the U.S. government bought all of the treasuries, right?
The Fed, right.
And then the government just said, okay, you know, we're not going to pay on them, and now they're worthless. That means the Federal Reserve would have no assets really on its balance sheet.
Right.
But it would still have all the liabilities. All the Federal Reserve notes would be in circulation, and the Federal Reserve would have no way to shrink money supply. It would have no way to respond to an increase in inflation, because it would have no assets to sell into the market to shrink the balance sheet. So we would just have massive inflation would result if the government defaulted. And of course, you know, a lot of the treasuries are in the hands of the Social Security Trust Fund and the Medicare Trust Fund. So are we, you know, defaulting on those too? because, you know, then, you know, where, you know, where is the money going to come from? Obviously, they were going to have to raise taxes anyway. But the other thing is, too, if the government just defaults on treasuries, I mean, and treasuries are the risk-free weight. I mean, they're only going to default on the treasuries that the Federal Reserve owns. Well, I guess if the Federal Reserve has bought every single treasury by then. But remember, in order for the Federal Reserve to buy up every single treasury, imagine how much the money supply is going to have to expand in order to make that possible. I mean, right now, the balance sheet is something like $7 trillion. Yeah. But how many, you know, the national debt is $27 trillion. So in order for the Fed to own every treasury, so we're not defaulting on the treasuries held in the private sector, I mean that's massive inflation just to do that. And then, of course, you solidify the inflation by, you know, by rendering them worthless. So that is not a get out of jail free card. That is a bigger disaster than what we would have to be confronted with if we just dealt with reality now.
Yeah, it's a great point about you can't do QT. Where are you going to go with that? That's a very, very good point. What do you say to people that always come back and say, well, Peter, I understand what you're saying, but why can't the United States beat Japan? Look at how much money they've printed. Look at 60% of the JGBs on the BOJ's balance sheet. And they've been doing this for decades and they're fighting deflation, not hyperinflation. So what's your rebuttal to that, those people?
Well, first of all, I mean, Japan is not, you know, what we want to use as an example to emulate. It's not like Japan is going to escape this scot-free. I mean, the Japanese have a big problem. And in fact, the Japanese economy would be in much better shape had they never gone down this road in the first place. But the reason that I don't think that we can get away with doing this as long as Japan has is because we don't have the domestic savings that Japan does. I mean, Japan finances all this internally. America is dependent on the rest of the world to be able to run these debts. So we're going to run out of rope a lot sooner than Japan did. Plus, look at the Japanese government. I mean, the Japanese government owns over $1 trillion in U.S. treasuries. I forget exactly how much. So, you know, we owe Japan a lot. So, you know, you could shrink the Japanese debt quite a bit if they liquidated those treasuries. They could retire a lot of JGBs. But at some point, there is going to be a debt crisis in Japan as well. I mean, I think the Japanese government is ultimately going to have to restructure the debt and they're going to have to default. I mean, there's no way it can be paid without, you know, having a massive inflation problem in Japan as well. So the Japanese are going to face their day of reckoning. There's no question. But also remember, Japan is a current account surplus. They have a trade surplus. So the structure of their economy is not nearly as screwed up as the U.S. economy. And so their day of reckoning is not going to be as bad as ours. And if we were ever able to get our national debt to the same percentage of GDP that they have, I mean, it would be just an even bigger disaster for us. And also because our GDP is a lot more fluff. I mean, our GDP is very much dependent on consumers spending borrowed money. That's not the case in Japan. I mean, you have a much healthier GDP in Japan than the United States.
Why does running a trade surplus give them so much more runway as far as inflation in the currency compared to the United States that is always running a trade deficit and maybe an even growing trade deficit?
Well, when you have a trade deficit, you're exporting dollars. So there's an excess supply of dollars on the global market every year. And those dollars need to go somewhere. Yeah. And right now, people are content to buy treasuries or buy other dollar-denominated debt or maybe buy into our stock market. But to the extent that foreigners have a, you know, less than favorable outlook on the future value of the dollar and our financial markets, then they're just going to sell those dollars to get back their own currency. So you have a lot of downward pressure on your currency when you're running a trade deficit, which puts more upward pressure on inflation and interest rates. If you have a trade surplus like the Japanese, there's real demand for all the yen because people want to buy the products. So Japan has enough products to absorb all of the yen. And in fact, it's exporting more. So it's got a surplus. So it's in a much stronger position than the United States, which is beholden to the willingness of foreigners to continue to recycle their surpluses into our financial assets.
Okay, so Peter, I could go on and on about that topic. That was fantastic. But I know you're running short on time. And so obviously I want to talk to you about gold and silver and precious metals. And I think what I'm seeing a lot in my comments of my YouTube channel and on Twitter is people are just wondering, is gold still cheap? And if it's still cheap, you know, should they buy now? What's the future look like? And maybe more importantly, a lot of people are asking, how do I know when to sell my gold? I think that's a question that most people don't ask enough. They kind of maybe know when to buy, but you know, when do you sell?
Yeah, you know, I obviously don't, because I didn't sell my gold when it got to 1900 in 2011. So I wrote, you know, of course I started buying it below 300. And my average price is considerably below where we are now. But I still think gold is cheap. I mean, because I still think the dollar is expensive. And so it's kind of the opposite side of that seesaw. And I think that there's going to be a lot more dollars created in the future than have already been created in the past. But I don't think there's a lot of gold that's going to be mined in the future. I mean, the mining output is very restrained. I think over the next 10 years, we could end up mining less gold per year than has been the historic average. So I just don't see a big increase in the supply of gold, but I see a huge increase in the supply of dollars, probably an unprecedented increase in the supply of dollars. And so what gold is really measuring is the purchasing power of those dollars. And look, Warren Buffett can see that. That's why he's moved into Barrick Gold. And I think that's the beginning of a much larger position that he is going to be accumulating on behalf of Berkshire to try to preserve purchasing power in a highly inflationary time period. As far as when you would sell your gold, look, I mean, sell it for what? I mean, get back into the dollar. Look, as far as I'm concerned, the buy signal for the dollar, right, which would be a sell signal for gold, is going to be when we finally swallow the bitter tasting medicine that we've avoided swallowing for decades. So I want to see the Federal Reserve get religion. I want to see interest rates go way up. I want to see the stock market, the bond market, the real estate market come crashing down. And I want to see no bailouts. I want to see the government restructuring. I want to see the government cutting spending, telling people who were expecting government checks that they're not going to get them, you know, including entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, pensions. Everything has to be on the table. We have to have a real day of reckoning. And then we have to understand that it was government, socialism, central banking that is the root cause of the problem. And we have to go back to a more free market-based economy with sound money based on savings, under consumption, capital investment. So when we do all the right things, of course, it's going to look very bleak. Everyone's going to be negative. There's going to be plenty of blood in the streets, right? And I'm going to understand that everything that we're doing, as painful as it may be in the short run, is exactly what we need in the long run. And there'll be tremendous value in the U.S. marketplace for people who have the buying power. Most people won't have any because they would have been wiped out in the inflation. But if you have gold and you have foreign assets that you can repatriate, I think you know, fortunes will be made based on the bargains that will be available. But that all assumes that we do the right thing. We may never do the right thing. We may interpret this disaster as just an indictment of capitalism and just go all in on socialism, in which case you never want to sell your gold. You want to take it with you when you leave the country.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what you're describing right there, it sounds a bit like 1981 when Volcker just took rates up close to 20%, and we just bit the bullet. Yeah. And had that huge recession.
And Reagan came in and at least on the surface repudiated the big government policies of the Rockefeller Republicans that you know that preceded him. Not just the big Democrats like LBJ, but you know Nixon. And we went back to, hey, let's cut taxes, let's have a smaller government. Even though we didn't succeed in shrinking government, Volcker did succeed in breaking the back of inflation and allowing interest rates to go up to 20%. Can you imagine what would happen today if the Federal Reserve did something like that?
Yeah.
We don't even have the ability. Look what happened to the economy in the fourth quarter of 2018 when rates were 2.5%. The whole thing imploded. I mean, how are we going to let them go to 20%? The reality is we have to. And in fact, if rates went to 20% in 1980, when we had a lot more savings and a lot less debt than we have now, if the market was setting interest rates today, the equilibrium rate would be much higher than 20%.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and so because, but we can't afford it. So the only way we can afford all that debt is if we default on it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what does the end game look like if the Fed doesn't have a Volcker or whatever, someone who's willing to jack rates just to sky high levels, and they just peg the yield curve and pray? I mean, what is that? How does that
look? I think it looks like Argentina, you know, any place else that's gone through. I don't think it's going to get as bad as Zimbabwe, you know, or Weimar Republic Germany. I mean, that's a worst case scenario, yeah. But I don't think that is the most likely outcome, or even Venezuela. I don't think we'll get as bad as Venezuela, but Argentina, I think, you know, it's pretty likely that we'll, you know, kind of follow in that path. I mean, the Argentine peso didn't get zeroed out, you know, and, yeah. you know, Buenos Aires, you know, I mean, it survived. But, you know, Argentina is a shadow of its former self. I mean, at one point, Argentina was a much larger, much more important economy. You go back to the beginning of the 20th century, you know, early 1900s, you know, their share of global GDP was much, much higher than it is today. They were a much bigger economy before they wrecked their currency.
Yeah.
And so I think America is going to come down quite a few pegs, you know, in the global pecking order. I think the dollar is going to lose its status as the reserve currency. And, you know, I think we're going to see a very, very sharp decline in the American standard of living relative to the standard of living throughout the world. So it's going to be a huge rude awakening for Americans. And it's unfortunate because, you know, we really blew something good. I mean, we had a fantastic free market economy. We had limited government. We had a constitution. We had everything going for us. And we blew it. You know, and it's just really sad. It makes me sad as an American to see, you know, what we've done to our country and what's happening to it now. I mean, it's getting much, much worse.
Yeah, that's for sure. Okay, so I'm gonna let you go, Peter. What was your rationale for the supply side of gold maybe being constricted moving forward? And then if you could just tell us and the viewers where they can find out more about what you do, Euro Pacific Capital, your website, your whatever you'd like to promote.
Oh yeah, I didn't even realize it was this late. I got a live hit, satellite hit. But yeah, I mean, gold, the supply is constrained because we haven't been mining enough. We haven't been developing new mines. We haven't been exploring. Okay. So we're just not gonna get a lot of supply, but we're gonna get a hell of a lot of demand. People can follow me at shiftradio.com or on my YouTube channel, The Shift Report. And if you're looking to get out of US dollars, contact me and my representatives at Euro Pacific Capital, europac.com. You can buy physical gold and silver at shiftgold.com. You got to act quickly. You got to divest of dollars. The inflation tax, and inflation is a tax, it's going to destroy the people who haven't prepared in advance to avoid it. You avoid it by getting out of the dollar, getting into foreign equities, getting into precious metals, getting into mining stocks. I think, you know, there is a path to prosperity here, but you have to make sure that you're on it. Most people are not. I can help you, but you got to act quickly because I don't know how much longer the window of opportunity is going to remain open.
Okay, Peter, I know you got to get going. We'll leave it at that. Thank you for your time. Can't wait to do it again, my friend.
Take care. Keep up the good work.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.